But in a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
There's a website I read every morning, and so does every journalist, particularly every columnist in the country. It's called Real Clear Politics, and you get on Real Clear Politics, you are a happy writer, I'll tell you that. It's a website that aggregates all the columns and news from all over the country, and it's kind of balanced. It's not wacky and wild like some of the other websites out there. And the founder of it is from Chicago, friend of mine, the pride of Princeton University, Tom Bevin. Do we have the pride of Princeton on the phone?
We do.
Hey. It is just an amazing thing that you've been able to put together over the past... When did you start, Tom?
2000, so 17 years.
My God.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Well, let me ask you this. This podcast will be up during Holy Week, and right outside Damascus, missiles have dropped by the United States. How does all that change everything, if anything, in Washington?
That's a great question. I don't know. I mean, I think the strikes themselves, I think what's important is what comes after. You know, what is the Trump administration? What is their plan? What was the design of this? You know, is this a real shift for Trump? Obviously, Trump had railed against Barack Obama and his, you know, involvement in Syria and the fact that he drew this red line and backed away. He tweeted, I think, in 2013 that he didn't think Obama should attack Syria even after the first chemical weapon attack. So I think we have to wait and see exactly what this portends. Other than, I think it's a show of sort of force and resolve on the part of the Trump administration. You know, that there's a new sheriff in town, and that, you know, if you violate, in this case, you know, the sort of international conventions on chemical weapons, that, you know, Trump is going to take action. And that's what he did.
The most unfortunate thing about it, besides the loss of life of all those people in Syria and those who were killed by the bombs, I thought was domestic politics. I could still see some on the left putting out snarky tweets. And I thought, and these are columnists and commentators, and I thought, my God, man, can't you just pull back a little bit? Because the time of snarky tweets might have been entertaining, but dropping bombs and geopolitical issues that could flame up into a serious war, that's the job of grown-ups, not snark. Have you seen a lot of that?
Not as much. I mean, look, I think most of what I've seen is that Democrats who, you know, have by and large, I think, supported this response. I mean, it gets very, very complicated, John. You know this. I mean, there's a whole section of the Democratic Party that, and even previous members of the Obama administration that, you know, practice this R2P, responsibility to protect, this humanitarian interventionism, right? Samantha Power and those folks wanted us to get involved in, you know, Congo and all these places. And when there's a humanitarian, this is why we were in Libya, because there was an impending humanitarian crisis there, they said. So we needed to take action. They were arguing that, you know, what's been going on, the civil war that's been going on in Syria, we are morally bound to protect all of these folks, innocent people who are being displaced and killed and whatnot. And then you've got the sort of neoconservatives on the right, who John McCain, Lindsey Graham, who have been advocating for forceful intervention in Syria. And so you've got this. Meanwhile, Donald Trump ran sort of expressly against the Bush foreign policy and the Obama foreign policy and the interventionist foreign policy of the past two administrations. So I think everybody's a bit discombobulated.
Correct.
And the real question is, what is Trump? What is he? What comes next? I mean, is this the sort of? Is he going to follow along with, some sort of? Is this going to be sort of the Trump doctrine? Is he going to fall back in with some of the folks from the Bush administration and the John McCain's of the world? Or is this merely sort of a one-off that is intended to send a message not only to folks in the region, but to, Putin and to, the prime minister of China, the premier of China, and some of these other countries? And we don't know the answer to that yet.
Also, we don't know if... once the bomb started dropping, I thought, is Elliot Abrams going to swim up the Potomac River and Steve Bannon will float away in a barrel someplace? Because you have that. And you also have, this constant drumbeat by the Democrats. It almost became ridiculous, the sort of Vladimir Putin as the evil James Bond villain and Donald Trump as the cat with the orange hair in his lap being petted. All that gets tossed now because Syria, the Assad is a client of the Soviet Union. And by military force, we run the risk of, hitting Russians, killing Russians. Maybe, you put Russian planes and American plane jets in the air at the same time, you could have problems. So where does that Trump as the servant of Putin go, and how does that play out?
Well, look, I think this does crimp that narrative for the time being. I'm sure Democrats will return to it when it's politically expedient for them to do so. But yeah, sure. I mean, that's why some Democrats, I think, are in some ways they've been favorably disposed to this because perhaps. They wanted to see America sort of stand up to Putin and to Assad and whatnot. And Trump has certainly sent that message. The other interesting debate, and as a libertarian, John, you will know Rand Paul and was eager to jump on this.
Yes.
But also Nancy Pelosi and Democrats were saying that, questioning the constitutionality of this and that Trump. He needs to come to Congress and get authorization. He can't just engage in war. Now you saw Marco Rubio come out and say it was, this is the president's job because it's chemical weapons. It's in our national interest to do this. And the president doesn't need congressional authority. But now we're talking about that whole authorization for the use of military force debate again, which we had when Obama, when he was thinking about doing a strike, he ended up going to Congress and then pulling the plug on it after, it didn't look like he was going to get it. So we're engaged in that debate again as well.
Also, the bottom line in all this, I'm very sorry that clearly that, people were hurt in Syria. I find that we are selective outrage on what humanitarian, terrors happen. We pick based on our own politics and our own maybe other agendas, but there's been genocides in Africa. We didn't do much about it. There's genocide in Sudan. We don't do much about it. There's genocide in Syria where Christians, I know this is an odd formation for many Americans who've been raised up in sort of the evangelical political sphere, but Christians have been in Syria since Paul was on the road to Damascus. And I don't think many Americans truly understand. It's almost like, they're, thinking they're all Muslims, and they're not. And the Valley of Christians has been decimated and destroyed by many of the rebel forces that we say we want to help against Assad. How do you balance all that?
Yeah, look,
during Holy Week, Tom Bevin, during Holy Week.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is one of the questions about, because Trump just last week was tweeting about staying out of Syria. And then, you know, he turned around and gave this in this joint press conference that he had the other day, was talking about, he was asked about chemical weapons and was talking about the beautiful babies that were killed.
You knew it
and
was
the,
coming,
and look,
right?
The images that came out of Syria in the aftermath of this chemical attack were horrifying. I mean, horrifying. I mean, as a father, you know, I could barely even stomach looking at them. But and this is one of the questions, like, you know, how much of this was driven by the sort of pure emotion, and is that how we should be conducting our foreign policy? And how much of this was driven by other concerns about geopolitical power, Trump's standing in the world, you know, all that stuff? Right. We don't know those answers yet, and we're going to find those answers out, I think, as not only as there's more reporting done on exactly what, you know, transpired over the last 24, 48 hours, but as we move forward and Trump has to make now, to your point, when Russia decides to retaliate or not, what are our next moves in the region? What are we going to do? I think that will help us, I think, also inform us as whether, you know, whether this was, how strategic this was, how much of a shift in policy this was, and how much of this was just sort of reactive and emotionally based.
Also,
I should interject here. Fox News, as we're recording this, Fox News is reporting that Russian ships are entering the Mediterranean.
Of course they would.
Right, but just for bringing us up to speed on that. But Tom, on that note, I mean, you think his policy, Trump's policy, is changing, or is this just gut reaction? I mean, something that, like, he found a time to try and change the narrative, because everyone was talking about all this other stuff that was pointless.
You're saying wag the dog, Jeff?
Well, I mean,
that's where you're going, huh?
A little bit. I mean, Bush didn't go after WMD right away. I mean, he tried to push the UN to kind of help him in Iraq originally. And there were no awful things going on there. And John's mentioning stuff, you know, going on in Africa. So why this? I mean, do you think there's an element there?
Well, I mean, if you believe the Trump administration, right, what they are saying is their justification for this and Trump's sort of change of mind was the nature of the attack itself. That these, you know, we were supposed to have cut a deal. John Kerry and Barack Obama said that there were no more chemical weapons in Syria, and that they had cut a deal with the Russians 100%. To make sure the chemical weapons were gone, 100% gone, right? And so this attack comes out. It's clear it's chemical weapons. It's pretty clear it happened on behalf, you know, was perpetrated by the Assad administration, and the Russians came out with this sort of silly cover story that no, this was done by the rebels, or that we hit this chemical plant that, you know, the rebels had, and from the reporting that I've seen, you know, was sort of A, laughable, and B, annoyed the administration that they were trying to, you know, think that the American public or, you know, our government was stupid enough to believe this. And so they responded. And I think that was if you believe that's true, and look, I have no reason to doubt that at this point, that was a major factor of why the Trump administration decided to take this action. And again, from what we've heard already, they alerted the Russians that this was going to take place so that there wasn't any sort of collateral damage on the Russians. They just wanted to destroy the airfield and you know, deteriorate Assad's Air Force capabilities from dropping future, you know, bombs and barrel bombs and chemical weapon attacks. So there was a method to this, I think, if you believe the Trump administration. And, you know, hopefully it's not one of those things that, you know, leads to gets escalated. I mean, a lot of that has to do with how the Russians respond, and we'll see.
One of the reasons why, besides your clarity of mind, and I'm not joking, even though I think you invited me to lunch and I didn't avail myself of a free lunch. One of the other reasons is that as the boss of Real Clear Politics, and everyone should go to this site because it's the first site I go to in the morning and follow it all day. And when my column's not there, I'm like, damn it. But it is just an awesome site. What I found at the moment of the attack, of our missile attack, I was flipping through the channels, and I'm watching an amazing phenomenon in journalism, which is before people know what the story is, you can kind of see people flailing about wondering where consensus will be. They're looking for the consensus. They're looking for the safe space from which to pontificate. And there's not enough information coming in. And so, you know, they get into some old formulas and then new ones. And then they start repeating themselves to each other as they're talking. And then the next day and the next 2 days or so come the op-eds in the papers that Real Clear Politics picks up and puts on the Real Clear Politics site and all the video that people, you know, where actors say what they say. And I'm wondering, since in that period, I know it's only been a short time, but do you see, I mean, are you going to be watching what pundits, how pundits deal with it and whether they shift or not in terms of their positions vis-a-vis Trump?
Sure. I mean, that's always one of the things is you take a look at
Jennifer Rubin, for example.
Right, exactly. I mean, John Podhoretz, New York Post, is writing, you know, favorably about this. And and you always, I mean, if you follow this stuff closely and you're sort of involved in the nuances of this, and because the country is, there are a lot of orthodoxies and partisan, you know, divides, a lot of times you can tell where
exactly.
You can tell where you stand by where other people are sitting. Right. And so we do look at all these and try and assess, okay, well, and try and put a compilation of that on the page to give our readers a flavor of, okay, this is, you know, the biggest names in the business are, this is what they're writing. This is what they're saying. And we'll contrast that with other members of, if it's a, you know, factions within the Republican Party
exactly.
or conservatives. And also the same with the Democrats. And so, yeah, that's, and you're right, John. I mean, a lot of times the snap decision is cable news. They've got to fill space. And so you get immediately, you know, get people on, get them talking about what's going on, even as we're still in that sort of fog of war. We don't know all the details. We're speculating. We're guessing. You know, people start to write commentary and it'll be, this is the sort of interesting period over the next, you know, over the weekend and through the Sunday shows as people sort of get their bearings and you will see, I think it will be very interesting to see how this all plays out and how the you know, partisan landscape assorts itself based on what's happened here. Because, you know, I was watching a couple of Democrats. I mean, they really, you know, Nick Kristof, for example, was a liberal columnist for the New York Times, was on CNN this very morning. And it was like he was sort of haltingly saying something favorable about Donald Trump. I think it was the first time that he probably said anything favorable about Trump. And he even prefaced it by saying, I don't agree with Trump on a lot of this, but I think he did the right thing here. And you know, he was pressed by Chris Cuomo about, well, was this legal? And should he said, well, it may not be totally legal. It's sort of dubious legality, but I still think it was the right thing to do. And so you've got even some Democrats and liberals who despise Trump. And it's like the only thing that they've has animated them over the last 78 days has been opposition to Trump and everything that he has done and said, who are now confronted with the idea that they may agree with the decision that he made. And so that will be interesting to see how that cognitive dissonance plays out.
On that point, I've seen it on social media within my own friends, and John knows a lot of my friends tend to lean a little more liberal, but they have come out and even said, well, okay, after that speech last night, that address, I mean, this is a president, I can finally start to maybe feel good about what my president's doing, because it does at the end of the day seem like we're on the side of right here.
Look, I think Democrats will very quickly be, again, depending on how things work out, even though they might have agreed with Trump in this particular instance, I don't think it'll take very long for them to find things to say critical about him. And you know, for example, we have Andrew Sullivan on the site this morning and he's, you know, talking about, and you see this in some other publications, Politico, you know, Trump's whiplash on Syria, his new doctrine is unpredictability and incoherence.
Right. They'll try anything. You're right. They're going to go there.
Right. They may agree with this decision, but very quickly they'll probably find out or come to the conclusion, whether it's for partisan purposes, that he didn't do it for the right reasons, that he was doing it because of, you know, peak or emotion or
plus
something.
They're the left is always preoccupied, I mean, almost obsessive with process. And the process, you know, the process stories that they learn to when they're covering government in their state, in state houses, and taking on to, you know, Washington. And it's just a it's just the way they think. They think in terms of process all the time. That's
yeah, and not only that, I mean, look, the base of the Democratic Party is so rabidly anti-Trump at this point that I don't even know that they're willing to concede, you know, anything.
But it changed the subject from Gorsuch, didn't it?
Well, yeah, but I mean, but Democrats in Congress right now, they can't even say anything even remotely positive about Trump without getting an earful from members and, you know, voters back home. And so I think whatever praise Trump will find from Democrats on this issue will be fairly muted and not very long lasting.
I have to, before we close, I have to ask you, it's Holy Week. Easter Sunday's coming. When you put the site together on Easter, is there anything that goes in your mind as you approach it, or do you just stay with the political or the events?
We usually try and take into account, whatever the day it is, whether it's a holy day or a holiday, or for example, the other day, yesterday, in fact, ironically enough, was the anniversary of the hundred year start of World War I.
Correct.
And we'll run a couple pieces on that, or if it's D-Day or whatever. And so we will certainly make sure that'll be covered on the site this weekend, obviously.
There's always the one thing I like about Real Clear is that while you get the best pundits and all that stuff and your Real Clear average and so forth, political average, that it's like a good barometer of culture. You also mentioned the integration of culture and politics, culture and process and government. And I'm a big fan of the site, and that doesn't mean that I'm not buying lunch next time, because I am. Okay? It's on me. All right?
That's a deal.
All right, Tom Bevin, Real Clear Politics. You see him on TV talking, giving wisdom, and he's right here with us because he's from this. He lives here. Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot, Tom, and have a happy Easter to you and your family.
All right. Same to you, John.
All right, Tommy. See you.
Bye.
Handshake song. That's why he made the handshake song. We don't know how to do the cup thing. We don't know what Anna Kendrick sings. That's why he made the handshake song.
You know what? I'm going to buy that little robot that turns. You put it on top of a jar and you press it.
I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. I put it on Facebook and people are like, "No, it works. No, it works."
No, that's why. Yeah, you got something that works too. It's called your big meaty paws.
Yeah, my big meaty paws, exactly. The butcher's hands.
Yes.
Okay.
They're very soft and delicate these days.
It is, isn't it? Aren't they?
Yeah, it is. It's an interesting handshake with John Cass.
As I write about Rahm with his in his dancer tights.
Yes.
The mayor did call me on that column as I was driving in.
Today?
To the city. And yes, and he said, "Thank you. I don't know what the hell you're talking about. And I'm sending you tickets to Dan's concert." And I'm like, "Well, I cannot accept it."
Right.
"But thank you for your thoughts, even though you don't understand what the hell I'm writing
wait,
about."
Wait, you knew what I was writing about. You got to do this for the podcast.
We are doing it for the podcast. He's rolling.
Oh, right.
This is Ben Bradley of WGN. The last time I saw you, sir, you weren't dressed in the word picture now, in a perfect, almost like kind of half Armani but half conservative gray suit with gray pocket square and an awesome very finely striped shirt. You were in your car in a t-shirt and a stupid baseball hat on something with your hair flying.
It's Cubs, so you
and you're
stupid.
Pulling in front of my house.
Yeah.
And you're saying, "Hey, do you have any lamb?" Right? I haven't seen you.
Yeah, I was on my 2 months.
For a year, for God's sake.
No, I think I was on my sabbatical.
Oh, is that it?
Yeah, unshaven, hadn't showered in days.
Yeah, you look
looking
like,
for lamb handouts in the suburbs.
You looked like a former community college professor who got caught up in some sort of scandal and had lost his gig.
Yeah, yeah. No.
And here you are, the anchor of at WGN. You're still in the market. You're doing well. It's great to see you. And I think, how's it going on WGN? How do you like doing
it? It has been
TV
outstanding. As you know, ABC 7, where I spent 14 years, is a phenomenal place, and I had great opportunities. But to go to WGN, where they said, hey, we see what you do, and we want you to do it all the time. And by the way, we'll give you the time and the resources to do it, and you can have more than 90 seconds for a story.
Right.
That's a broadcast journalist's dream right there. Plus, oh, you get to anchor the 4 p.m. news. Okay.
So that's a lot of lifting, though. That is,
yeah, but it's,
that is, people know you start the 4 p.m. news. You don't just roll out of bed at 1 o'clock, no. And it's not like the old days where
you park on the curb.
Where Fahey Flynn and everybody would go, you know, Fahey, don't step off the Fahey, watch it. You know, no one has to tell Fahey you're not Fahey. You have to get up early. You got a 4 o'clock newscast. When do you start working at it? About the night before?
Well,
I would say.
Just like anyone in our business, I think you're constantly thinking about the next story and you're constantly juggling several angles and
right.
several stories. So it's not really hours-wise. But, yeah, you go in the morning. Yesterday, for example, I had a couple of shoots for a few investigative pieces that we've got working on. Then, you know, you
well, do you want to tell me what they are?
Yeah, I'd love to.
Okay, go
really
ahead.
Love
Let me
to.
Hear.
No.
Okay.
And then early in the afternoon is when you start kind of diving into, okay, what's the content of the 4 p.m. news going to be? Meanwhile, you've got a whole team of people out that have already been reporting the stories and producing and writing them all day long.
So and the demographics, I don't know what they are, but based on, you know, I've only been in the business like 6 months mm-hmm. now. And when I started 6 months ago, we had people assigned to watch the 10 o'clock news. That's what you watched.
Right. The newscaster.
And I'm not saying people don't watch the 10 o'clock news,
mm-hmm.
but by 10 o'clock, they've been on their phones all the time. They do watch the early
right.
news, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock news. Isn't that odd how that works? How
yeah.
That
and it affects all of our businesses because it's this false impression. Sometimes it's real, but I think a lot of times people have this false impression that because they've been on their phones all day, they're informed. Yeah, they've
herded like livestock. Into,
right, they've seen a couple of tweets and Facebook posts
right.
that agree with what they already think.
Jay Cutler's butt looks good from here.
Right, yeah. right, great. I'm informed.
Can I quote you on that, John?
Yeah, please. Don't quote
you're still
me on
thinking
that.
About gonna, it's been like a week, and
yeah,
you're still thinking about Cutler's.
No, I'm just thinking of what people think is right. important.
Yeah,
what
it,
drives you know you can write, you can do a. A detailed analysis about like budgets for the mm-hmm. for state of Illinois with thousands of people leaving every day
mm-hmm.
running like economic refugees from
right.
the windswept
right. Indiana's gonna put up a wall pretty soon.
Windswept wastes of Madaganistan. And but if Jay Cutler's wife takes a picture of his butt, that's right. not did you put the butt on your 4 o'clock?
No, we did not put the butt on the 4 o'clock.
Did you have like a,
we
I shall
that for
not
Sepulsa,
put the
yeah.
butt on
yes.
the 4 o'clock?
No, there was not a great you know journalistic debate about it. The truth is at the 4 o'clock, I wasn't anchoring the 4 o'clock the day that came out.
Thank God, right?
But no, that, you bring up a great point, though, about social media, and it's what's so frustrating to me. And I don't know if you see it on your page. I know you're very active on Facebook and Twitter as well. But Facebook specifically, if I post a link to an investigation that I spent a lot of time on, and I'm very proud of, that I think is interesting.
And you know? you've got to start tagging me on that. So
okay, we'll do. But right. if I post the link to that story,
mm-hmm.
it'll get a little bit of traction. It'll get you know a handful of likes and you know a couple comments mm-hmm. from people who always comment, which we appreciate. But if I post a picture of you know. Lourdes and I out at a charity thing, you know, socially, my co-anchor Lourdes and I, or
right.
I post a pic, you know, if I do a link to the damn giraffe that's been giving birth for 6 months, that will do so much better on social media. And it becomes a self-fulfilling thing where the more people like a post, the more Facebook pushes it out to other people. So that's why you tend to get the non-important stuff, the unimportant stuff on Facebook.
Right, because we don't want to be informed. What we want to do is end up like those creatures in the Monty Python, King Arthur film, where we're building huts. Yeah, we're building huts out of mud. We're just in the mud with mud in our hands talking politics, but we're in the mud.
Right.
That's where we –
Right. And we feel good about ourselves because we're in the mud.
I'll tell you something. We have our guest, Mr. Ben Bradley, on here on the Chicago Way, and he's always – I've always liked him. We're friends, but we do tease each other on occasion. And sometimes Ben will give me a shot, like, you hate broadcast news. He always does that. Why do you think I hate broadcast news, Ben, since I'm broadcasting now?
I don't know if you've read some of the columns you've written over the years, but I have.
I'm not talking about you.
Well, you know, but that's like saying I hate all short people except for you.
How about short fat people with hair in their back and bow-legged?
Yeah, don't get me started on
a guy and I go up to his house in the middle of the afternoon saying, "You got a chunk of lamb for me?" Yeah, that guy.
For the record, I wasn't, stalking Cass. My brother lives down the block.
He lives down the block. I like Ben. It's not like he's – although people did – people have said to me, our house was occupied by some work that was going on. Mm-hmm. So I said, I've been writing the column a lot from home. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll go out and report and then just drive home rather than hit traffic coming out of here at 6 o'clock, or 7. And my deadlines are earlier now, the 6 o'clock deadline. So so I hit a local Starbucks, okay, in the suburban town that I'm not going to say, but I live.
Yeah.
And I tried to get some work done, and it's like everyone's coming up. I love that.
Yeah.
I love that when people say hi.
Right.
But I had to leave.
It's tough. You know, all those moms and the Lululemon coming up to you and
now see, there's you going again.
Well, no, I've been to that Starbucks.
I know we have the hottest moms in the world, and they're very nice and ladylike and right, Jeff Carlin.
Absolutely.
You've been to that Starbucks.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
best in the burbs.
Friendliest people.
Mm-hmm.
Although you know what, the guy at Starbucks, he's like, are you going to write that our snacks suck again? And I said, what do you mean? He goes, well, last time you were here writing a column, you wrote that. I did. I must have. I said, wrote something like their snacks. They do suck.
They're terrible.
Why do they suck?
Because they're mass produced. Ugh. And you and I are used to kind of old school, real sustenance.
Weber Bakery. Look at how look at how Ben Bradley is throwing the little the plug on top of the water, twitching it like for the best.
I like that. Wait, can we get back to some of the stuff you've written about broadcast?
Go ahead. Bring it.
No.
This is podcasting.
I'm curious, though, as you've crossed that red line.
Oh, when I had the kids going to college and I had to do that WLA. Oh, I'm sorry, that other place that fired me? Yeah.
As you cross that red line that you as a newspaper columnist never thought you would
never
cross.
Never thought I'd do.
Do you have? I remember a conversation you and I had out on State Street years ago.
Not many.
For full disclosure, an old studio we were in happened to be above Ben's studio at a certain building.
Yes, and we used to see each other all the time.
And I remember first talking to you about making the transition to broadcast. And I said, I think you've taken a lot of shots at broadcasting, many of them deserved.
Yeah.
over the years, I think what you're going to find is when you're doing it every single day for a couple hours. It's okay to sometimes do the frivolous stuff.
I do it too. I do four a week. So sometimes I will write about, I'm not going to write about the water skiing squirrel.
Right.
But I will do, I don't know, my dog. I betrayed my dog. Although
Zeus,
I did betray Zeus.
Right.
But you can't do
Zeus
broadcast.
And the columns probably do better,
isn't
don't
that
they?
Odd? They do pretty well.
It's disheartening sometimes, I think.
I just
more
think
people want to share and like Zeus than.
Yeah, they don't like me. They like
Madagascar.
I think it's because people like when you're writing a column or when you're an anchor in Chicago, talk show host like Rokan, you become part of the community.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not just the straight reporting that people want out of you. It's they want to know who you are, right? That's
it's,
why we.
It's
do
also
that.
A it's also kind of a Midwestern sensibility too, because you don't catch a lot of that stuff as popular in other places. It's just news. It's just getting down to brass tacks, or you're inundated with it in other places. Here, I find, especially in talk radio, you find that the news is people want news, obviously, but they also want to be entertained. They want to talk about their lives. They want to feel like they're part of a community, because there's some things that are just universal, like pets and kids and food. And so those things.
And like your dog crapping on somebody on Ben Brandley's lawn, and he comes out and you don't have a bag. And you're like, Ben, I'm sorry.
Exactly. And I think that also has a lot to do with where we are. I mean, I think the Midwest is prime for that. And it's one of those things that makes us unique, especially this market.
Very true.
Check out Jeff Carlin with a big brain.
Thanks, John.
Not bad. So Ben Brandley, what, but now that we're over this whole broadcast thing, blah, blah, blah. Holy Week. You're going to be an anchor. I write a Easter column every Sunday. Mm-hmm. I don't know if every Easter Sunday. I don't know if I'm going to write one this year. I don't know. I'm struggling with it. Maybe by the time you read it, hear this, maybe I'll have or not. How do we cover Easter as compared to Christmas on the news? Oh, there's a dangerous rickety bridge that I just put out for Ben Brandley to walk upon.
I don't think in the news we cover religion. We cover quasi-religious events. It's very easy to cover Christmas and hoopla and lights and shopping. And it's very easy for us as journalists to go to Holy Name on Easter Sunday and say, right, here's the message.
You can go to the Greek Orthodox Cathedral too, but anyway.
But don't you think Blaise Supich has done a better job of, I think, communicating in an easy way for us to then share the message of the Catholic Church? And by that, thinking within the last week or so about this letter from Pope Francis that Supich brought about Chicago violence. And Cardinal George used to speak in such a way that you had to be a scholar to understand it, let alone share it. And that's not a good thing.
Actually, I love Cardinal George, and I would go, and he would call me, and I would go sit down. I would spend hours with him. Mm-hmm. To me, he was a great intellect, mm-hmm, and the intellectual rock of the Catholic Church in America. The problem, and he would acknowledge this. Mm-hmm. The problem is being a bishop means you have to say what is what and what is not what.
Right,
and people don't like that. They want the soft thing. They want hugs.
Right.
They don't want to be told, hey, you're Catholic, so if you vote supporting abortion practices, your church is not going to like it.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody wants to hear that stuff. They want to be loved and hugged.
Didn't you always get the sense that Cardinal George was never comfortable in his role as the kind of public face, the communicator?
He was more comfortable writing.
Yes.
That's where he was more comfortable, because of the intellectual rigor. Although he was a gentleman when he would be, it's a difficult thing.
Yeah.
But I get your point about the events.
Mm-hmm.
The events, we can cover the event of something. Covering the culture and how we're approaching these great religious milestones in our year, whether they be the Christian Easter, which is mine and I think yours, or Ramadan, or other religions for other people.
Passover.
It's Passover, all that. It is difficult. It is a difficult thing. And it's got to be difficult for broadcast, except you put a picture up of the Orthodox and the Catholics fighting in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, where the monks are fighting or something, and you have your story.
Right.
Right?
But if you think about what's happening in our world just this week, and the fears and the baggage and all of it that goes along with it, wouldn't the public be better served by understanding the religious undertones that are shaping, quite literally, wars?
A civil war within the Muslim faith.
Mm-hmm.
Shia and Sunni.
Yeah.
Now the Sunnis are our friends because we bombed Syria, but the Syrians, the Assad protects the Christians who are being slaughtered by the people that we support.
Right.
How does this happen?
Same problem in Iraq.
You know, one thing about Ben Bradlee you should know, I've always been a big fan of his. I've always thought if I ran a television station, if I wouldn't make him anchor, which I would because he's just cool and I would say be the anchor of everything, I would have him cover politics 24/7. And I think that's where I know you covered politics at WLS, and I'm not disparaging others there, but I think the WLS management made a huge mistake in not promoting your political understanding, because I think, first of all, you like it, mm-hmm. and second of all, you get it.
Thank
why
you.
Why do you like it, and why do you think you get it?
Because it's a sport. You know, it is the ultimate sport that people in Chicago actually like watching almost as much as they like watching real sports. You know, I mean, look at Rahm Emanuel this week. It's very easy to send a camera or a print reporter or a digital reporter, whatever that means, you know, out to cover Rahm Emanuel saying, "We are entering into a game-changing event here.
Oh,
we are changing how and when we allow kids to graduate. And they will not get a diploma from Chicago Public Schools unless they have a plan." Okay, well, what does that mean?
I did a piece this week, last week, on Rahm's dancing. And guys called me up and said, "Oh, you're going to kick his butt because he's, you know, Rahm and the two, Rahm mm-hmm. and leotards dancing." First of all, I like dance. I'm not a great fan, but I married, as you know, Betty, yeah. Choreographer and dancer. And the whole point is of the column was to understand some parts of dance or boxing, you have to see where the fighters are not.
Mm-hmm.
In that space that they're not, in the negative space. And that is what you just referred to. Here comes Rahm saying, "I'm doing this, this, and this for the kids," but what's on the outside, the whole he sculpts a whole area that's not full, and you have to fill it to understand what that is. It to
pay no attention to the fact that our schools may close
right.
weeks early,
or not, and they don't
we
even
have no
produce.
Funding,
right?
And you know, it was an off the record conversation, so I can't get into it with Rahm. But you know,
so just leave the swear
this
words.
Notion,
out.
This notion. Everyone wants a higher graduation rate. Everybody yeah. wants to point to improved statistics. As you know,
liars, figure, liar. Right.
You know, I mean, in a lot of it's a 5-year graduation rate, not necessarily a 4-year graduation rate.
Tell me about it.
It's
as a dad.
You know, it's an interesting dance to use your metaphor. And I think oftentimes it's just a means of changing the subject or buying time.
It's all about buying time, I think. There's no money here in this town. There's no money in the state. The state is I can't tell you how many real estate agents came up to me the other day at that Starbucks saying, mm-hmm. you know, this state's going crazy. I mean, they see it. They feel it. What do you – I'd like to ask you a political question on that. Governor Rauner came into office to change the status quo. He was elected because of that.
Mm-hmm.
I supported him because of that. That his top political people don't choose to call me ever is I can deal with that. What I cannot deal with well is that he's floundering. What is going on with him?
I saw one of his new campaign commercials that he just debuted. And he's, you know, of course, he's in the plaid flannel shirt. Not, you know, he's dropping his G's, sounding just as folksy and as ever.
We're just at 100. We're at Archer in Central Park.
Exactly.
Talking like that. Yeah.
And in the end, he says, "My agenda is, my plan is." And I thought, wow, what an interesting campaign commercial for a guy who's been in office 3 years.
Right.
The commercial makes him sound like he hasn't been in power. Which, in truth, he hasn't been. what he's going to have to answer.
He could have had a, he could have pushed this thing. I'm elected the first year. Call everybody's bluff. Do what you have to do. Mm-hmm. He didn't do it.
Yeah.
He had people around him who didn't want to really fight. They're kind of like that Mark Kirk crowd of Republicans. Mm-hmm. Okay, they didn't want to fight. Now they're going to get new gigs. He'll be out. And either we'll have Kennedy or Pritzker who thinks they're going to deal with Madigan. I'm sorry.
So on the other side of the aisle, explain to me, because this is something that's puzzled me. When Rauner was elected, I think a lot of us in the media thought, okay, so Madigan's going to put up some sort of token fight and then let Rauner make all the hard decisions and all the unpopular choices and wear the jacket for it. Because Madigan knows there are serious problems in this state.
It's gone.
Yeah. Right. I can't figure out why Madigan hasn't done that. Because somebody at some point is going to have to do the unpopular stuff. And he had a great opportunity to let Rauner do it and take the blame for it. And then 4 years later, presumably under a better financial situation, put a Democrat back in and be able to run him and say, hey, look, you know, Rauner cut this and did that.
Just look at it before Rauner came in.
Mm-hmm.
Governor Quinn had a huge majority in a Democrat, huge majority in Springfield, and Rahm Emanuel's mayor. Did anybody do anything with all that juice and leverage and mojo that they had then?
Nope.
Nothing. Just kicking that can. But you know what?
So what's Madigan's play?
I think Madigan's play is trench warfare. This is 1918.
Feudalism. Yeah.
This is trench warfare. He figures he's in the trench and he will, you know, the others will quit because he's not going to quit.
So he's going to be standing in a trench.
You know what I'm saying? It's
But he's going to be standing in a trench, still holding the big sword, muddied, cut up.
What, like Henry V?
Yeah, but he'll be the survivor, right?
Yeah, and then we'll all be gone.
Of what?
Right, that's
a vast wasteland. And Madigan, I think, he had a, again, looking at this from Madigan's perspective, he had a great opportunity, I think, to win.
He's still in power, and you know where the good guys win? On the Chicago way. Is that clumsy enough of a segue out of here?
I liked it.
Ben Bradley, thanks for being here on WGN, 4 o'clock anchor, and also investigative political stuff that he does, which is great. Jeff Carlin, he of the big, you were like Barbara Tuchman there doing that whole, you know, cross-cultural migration of cultures thing.
I appreciate that.
And Tom Bevan from Real Clear Politics. I want everybody to have a happy, safe, and joyous Easter as we celebrate the resurrection of our Lord Jesus Christ. I know you're not supposed to say that in journalism, but I don't care anymore because that's where I am and that's where I'll be on Holy Week. Everyone have a great time. Cook your lamb. I'm not going to have enough for everybody, but if you call me for tips, don't call me on Sunday because I'm cooking. See you later, everyone.